Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and as a listener of Intelligent Medicine, you can try a bottle of their finest artisanal olive oil, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. I've been enjoying these harvest fresh olive oils for years. They are far and away the brightest, most lively, and flavorful olive oils I've ever tasted. Their antioxidants and polyphenols are off the charts because they're fresh from the harvest. They make store-bought olive oils taste dull and flat by comparison. Taste for yourself. Check out this generous trial offer and get your $39 bottle for a buck with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. Myfavoriteoliveoil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We're talking about genomic testing, and our guest is Dr. Sharon Hausman-Cohen. She is Chief Medical Officer and co-founder of IntelLex DNA. That's Intel with two L's, two X's, followed by DNA. You can get more information at IntelLexDNA.com. And so, Sharon, the question I might pose is, who might want to get genomic testing? What are the types of patients who are good candidates for this?
Well, we really have about three types of people that like to do this. The first group are people who are already having symptoms of a chronic disease. So they might be having mild cognitive impairment and they want to prevent Alzheimer's. And that's a pretty common reason that someone will come to an IntelLex DNA provider. The second type are people who can kind of see the future at being at risk. They have a little bit of a high blood sugar, or they know their cholesterol's high and their dad had heart disease. So they're starting to worry about chronic diseases. And those people are generally people in their 40s, 50s, 60s. And then the third type are people who just don't feel well. Maybe they're your medical mystery patient. Actually, there's a fourth type. So the medical mystery patient, and often they have problems with mitochondria, which have to do with energy production for the brain and the muscles. They'll have problems with detox pathways, which is the ability to clear different toxins and benzene and all kinds of things in our environment. And then the fourth group are the individuals that just want to be proactive. A lot of the millennials or Generation X, people mm-hmm. in their 30s and 40s, that are like, wow, we have this technology. Wouldn't it be great before I have an adverse reaction to anesthesia or before I get a blood clot while traveling over to Europe for me to know that I'm at higher risk and learn how to take care of myself and what things I need more of and what things I need less of?
You know, as a clinician, I would put it this way. It's great for patients who have challenging medical problems, especially when we don't have enough clues as to what to do, because, you know, the tests that we have are limited. But it's also great for patients who come and are desiring optimization, because it's really, in a way, it's hard to develop a dialogue that involves incisive, intelligent interventions for a patient who comes in and shows you blood tests and their cholesterol's great and they're taking a million vitamins and, you know, we can check for vitamin levels, but they're all going to be high. And maybe, you know, we could say, well, what's your family history? Okay, yeah, I have somebody, my grandfather had heart disease. But still, it's hard to determine if those familial risks have actually been passed along to them. And so it really informs our choices sometimes where our roadmap is kind of scanty. That's why I find it a valuable clinical tool. It really amplifies to a large degree the amount of data that we have to base clinical decisions on. So that's why I find it valuable.
You brought up a really good point about family history being limiting. I had one patient, and she had no family history of diabetes, but her hemoglobin A1C, which is a measure of your blood sugar over the last mm-hmm. 3 months, was running in the pre-diabetes range. And she's like, well, my grandfather had diabetes, but she was in her early 50s. But I don't think either my parents have it. And when we looked at her genes, we were able to see that she had just gotten one copy from mom and one copy from dad of a gene that one copy of gives you a slight increased risk, but two copies of it makes you not able to really respond to insulin and gives you almost a 7 times risk. And so when we understood what the underlying reason was for her risk of high blood sugar, we were able to respond to it better. And then she had a few other things that we were able to respond to with things like whey protein and things like taking a supplement that helps to release a hormone that helps you release more insulin. And so lots of different natural things. And she was able to get that back out of the pre-diabetes range. And so,
and this is actually where I find it very valuable, because when it comes to type 2 diabetes, you know, if a patient comes in and they're massively overweight and they're eating a lot of carbs, you know, our job as clinicians is fairly easy. We just say, okay, you know, exercise, lose weight, cut the carbs, and you know, you'll be fine. We'll get that hemoglobin A1C under 6. But then there's that type of patient who comes in and they're already thin, they're already eating a pretty good diet, and yet their hemoglobin A1C just, you know, is in the 6.5 range. They're not, you know, perhaps full-blown diabetic. They're not insulin-dependent diabetics, but they're the ones where we can sometimes discover problems, not so much with insulin resistance, but with insufficient secretion of insulin, short of insulin-dependent diabetes, that respond to things like gymnema, whey protein, other ways of getting the pancreas to be more responsive to signals to produce insulin appropriately.
Absolutely. And that we call those the skinny diabetics.
Yeah,
and again, that's about, yeah, it's about 7% of the population that will have two copies of that gene that you're talking about, which is called TCF7L2. It's just, it doesn't really matter what it stands for, but it's what's important is one copy of that gene decreases your ability for your stomach to signal to your pancreas, incoming carbs, you know, release the insulin by 30%. So for people who have two copies of it, they're down 60% that ability to handle carbs. And when they understand that, then we can say, you know, whey protein, if you use a high enough amount, can increase that release of the incretin, what they don't release, by over 150%. So again, then people are going to be much more compliant with diet, or they can choose to take medications, or they can choose to use supplements, because they know it's about them, not just about generic medical advice.
When it comes to obesity, there's a whole section of the Intellix panel which speak to the issue of obesity. And of course, there's not one single gene that gives you a propensity to overweight. It's literally hundreds of genes. You know, to make it a little bit simpler and more comprehensible, you boiled it down to, you know, perhaps a dozen or so genes that are highly deterministic about weight. But the good news here too is that not everyone with these genes is destined to be obese. We can, through various means, through dietary means, through exercise, through portion control, push back against that so that the phenotype, the actual end result of someone with some of these genes, may be normal weight, right?
Absolutely. I think that one of the most common collections of genes is something called STAT3, which relates to inflammation. But it's a really interesting
gene. Which, by the way, I have some of. You know, I've done this genetic testing. And yet, you know, I was a chubby child. But, you know, through, you know, good diet and exercise, I've maintained optimal weight. But maybe I am susceptible.
Well, the thing about it that's so interesting is it was meant to be a protectant against starvation. And so it only causes fat storage around your middle in the presence of excessive saturated fat. And if you were starving in Poland, you know, 100 years ago, and
like my ancestors.
Right, exactly. Mine too. And, you know, they only got access to animal meat once or twice every few months. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be to your benefit when it was beginning of winter and they were killing Bessie the cow for you to say, oh, I don't really want any, I'm not hungry. So when you eat saturated fat, it causes excessive storage of fat around the middle, but it was really a protectant. And with people who have this, if they just keep their saturated fat very low, they will not be heavier than people without these genes. But if you increase saturated fat, you can increase logarithmically the fat storage around your waistline. So that's a really powerful gene. I had one lady who she would struggle between being kind of a 12 to a 14, and she was only 5'4", so she didn't love that. And once she learned that she did better without saturated fat, she was able to lose that weight by eating really fish and plant-based, still ate fat, but things like avocados and nuts and seeds. And now she is generally between a 6 and an 8. So that's been really tremendous for her.
Yeah, I have an archival family picture of my great-grandmother standing in a marketplace in Warsaw, Poland, and it must be freezing because she's all covered up, and she's holding by the legs upside down the scrawniest chicken you ever saw. And, you know, it's so symbolic of, you know, I think for, it was like a kind of a big coup to be able to get a chicken and serve it up for a Sabbath meal. That kind of really illustrates the point, is that we do have thrifty genes that maybe are overwhelmed by the overabundance of foods that we have in the modern era.
That's right. And they wouldn't have wasted that saturated fat. They would cook up that schmaltz and eat
right.
the chicken liver and
nose
do everything.
To tail or beak
That's
to,
right.
to beak to beak to claw. And chicken feet weren't off the menu. When it comes to there are other things that are tested for in this series of genetic analyses. There's an interesting section on macular degeneration. And what's puzzling about macular degeneration is that some people are extraordinarily prone to macular degeneration. We know that Caucasian women are more prone to macular degeneration than African-American women, for example. So we know there probably is a genetic component, but your test really zeroes in on some of the risk factors. But then, you know, do people just have to resign themselves that they're inevitably going to go blind?
No, absolutely not. Again, everything that we look at has interactions with nutrition and with the environment. So if you know that you have one of the genes that tremendously increases the blood vessel growth in the back of the eye under times of stress, or that makes you have a pigment in the back of the eye that's more susceptible, just avoiding smoke and wearing blue light glasses and doing things like getting enough of certain nutrients that are found in leafy greens, like lutein and zeaxanthin, can be significantly beneficial. Combining those genes with smoke, and it could be smoking or it could be going out and barbecuing, can increase the risk of macular degeneration 15-fold. So avoiding smoke is something pretty easy to do. And then there's other genes that are regulated by zinc. And then there's other genes that are regulated, you know, that relate to pesticides and how you clear them. So when you know more about
it. So-called detox genes, things that have to do with glutathione, for example.
Yes, yes, that and another one called peroxidase, which is more like the pesticides and oxidative stress to your cholesterol. So when you, the more you know about it.
Excuse me, that may be why, you know, we know that farmers have a much higher incidence of Parkinson's disease. And yet there's some farmers who just spray indiscriminately over fields for their entire lifetimes and they don't come down with neurodegenerative diseases. Maybe they just don't have the SNPs that are associated with susceptibility.
Absolutely. So we see in the detox pathways, as you mentioned, glutathione, and I know this is kind of technical, but that's the master detoxer pathway. And we call it as a conjugator. So, you know, like conjugal relationships. So a glutathione attaches to toxins and removes it. And if you have problems with that ability to remove toxins, you're susceptible to so many more neurodegenerative diseases because you can't clear mercury, you can't clear glyphosates. And they did a study in a small village in Ecuador, which was a coffee growing village, that they used to. I say used to because they don't anymore because of the study. They used to spray the village with glyphosate before the harvest as part of keeping the crops under control. And then they found there's a famous geneticist in Ecuador that found that the women, and it's about 12% of the women, who had two copies of this one gene in that glutathione pathway had almost eightfold risk of having either birth defects in their children or miscarriages. So absolutely what is going on with your detox pathways is a huge factor for neurodegenerative diseases, as well as things like, of course, miscarriages.
In mercury detoxification, these pathways also play a role in handling mercury, because some people, you know, we're all exposed to it, and yet some people, you know, they say, well, mercury's harmless. Well, maybe in an aggregate population study, it's harmless, but some people seem extraordinarily susceptible. Perhaps it's because of the genetic SNPs that render them more vulnerable.
Right. There are different pathways that allow you to actually carry mercury back out of the brain. So if you're not good, and Caucasians have this particular combination of genes pretty frequently. So if you're not good at carrying that mercury back across the blood-brain barrier so it can be cleared by your body, that's a problem when you're playing with mercury as a kid or exposed to it accidentally because you eat too much fish or for any other reason.
To switch gears, another concern that people have when they undertake these tests is, you know, these days we're giving out all kinds of data, and, you know, data gets hacked routinely. You know, we just had the accounts of hundreds of millions of people hacked as part of a data breach at Capital One. You know, all their personal and financial information was released. How do we know that this information isn't going to get released, and then it may become prejudicial to us, you know, perhaps because we have bad genes, you know, a future employer or, you know, the government may find out that we have bad genes and that somehow they'll utilize this information for nefarious purposes. What's the confidentiality on this?
So there's a number of layers of confidentiality. First of all, we train our clinicians to realize that genomics is not part of their medical record. Now, pharmacogenomics, if you're doing drug metabolism, you may want that in your medical record. Mm-hmm. But when people go in for a genomic consult, Intellix DNA gives the clinicians a separate portal. It's not something covered by insurance, so it's not subject to release to insurance.
Okay.
But it's also stored under a barcode. So even our lab, and we use a well-respected university lab that does testing for different NIH studies and all kinds of studies, they do not even know whose DNA is whose. It's all stored under barcodes. And then our programmers also do work for the Department of Defense. So there's a number of levels of security protecting their ID. But again, we definitely take security very seriously. We never sell any DNA, things like that.
Right. And I think the business model for some of the companies that do DNA testing is they may sell you a $99 test kit, but what they're doing essentially is they're doing data mining, because they'll have you fill out a very elaborate questionnaire, sometimes hundreds of questions long, about all manner of health and lifestyle factors, so that they can then take the DNA results and sell them to pharmaceutical companies or companies doing research.
Right, and we do not do that. Our current panels are being used by research physicians, but we do not sell DNA to other researchers. Mm-hmm. If somebody wants to do, like I said, there's studies ongoing on things like Alzheimer's. There's actually an exciting study that's a future study on autism. And so people certainly use genomics for research, but we don't sell DNA or other people's data.
So you're working on, and this is not included in the current panel, but something in the future for Intellix DNA, a series of SNPs that may relate to autism susceptibility, not so much for family planning purposes, but perhaps to reveal therapeutic avenues for kids with developmental disorders?
Yes. Yeah, so part of autism. So there's part of autism that are those mutations. They're actually known. You would have to do whole genomic sequencing and look for rare mutations. But more than half of autism, you know, whether it's 50% or 70%, kind of depends on the population, is actually kind of more like Alzheimer's or heart disease, mm-hmm. where it's little variations that affect the gut, that affect the hormones like oxytocin that allow people to have social bonding, mm-hmm. that affect glutamate, which can be an irritant for the brain. And so we are collaborating right now with the Australian Center for Genomic Analysis, and Dr. Heather Way is doing some amazing work, and it's currently in alpha testing with a study that she has ongoing, and we have a few sites just starting to get involved in the United States. But we plan on having that come out in 2020, mm-hmm. but Dr. Way has already had hundreds of children that have on the spectrum that have gone from nonverbal to verbal using genomics, as well as addressing things like their gut. Mm-hmm. And we are, again, just starting to add some testing in the United States and having some really exciting results. So that's great.
It's of interest that in one very exciting trial, the nutrient sulforaphane was beneficial for kids suffering from autism. So that really does suggest a detox pathway, brain protective nutrient application, and that can actually sort of work with plasticity that's still available to these kids.
Absolutely. There's also one of the master inflammatory pathways, interleukin-1, is also modulated by sulforaphane, which comes from broccoli sprouts extract. But TNF-alpha and TNF-alpha levels, which is another really important inflammation pathway, have been shown to be much, much higher in children with autism. And so we can also look at people who abnormally make TNF-alpha. But there's just a whole, you know, the biggest problem with autism is choosing again, which are the ones that have the best studies, and what do we include so as not to make it an overwhelming report, but we still get good outcomes. But like I say, we're having, with our Australian expertise, we're having really some great preliminary results, and we're real excited to be able to help people have a better quality of life and kind of unlock those children. Dr. Way, with her own child, used genomics a number of years ago when she first started, and he was in diapers and nonverbal at 7. And within 6 months of genomics, he was mainstreamed in school and reading.
Wow. So that's just really exciting. And beyond just the niched area of autism, it really suggests the potential for optimization of many conditions that afflict adults without classic developmental disorders. So that is exciting indeed. So a couple of practical details. First of all, you're in private practice, although you spend a lot of your time working and developing the Intellix DNA test and helping clinicians to implement it and educating clinicians on how to interpret it. Is that correct? Is there, you have a center in Austin, Texas?
Yes. So we have a small private practice that I call our playground for the genomics, but it also allows us to stay current on what's going on in integrative medicine. It's called Resilient Health, Resilient Health Austin, and it's myself and a couple other physicians and the co-founder of Intellix DNA, who is an integrative manual therapist, but also excellent leader and businesswoman. So we have that in Austin, and then we also... Again, Intellix DNA is being used across the country. We don't have every state yet because we did just launch last November, but we have in most major mm-hmm. cities and states wonderful practitioners, including the Naples Center in Florida that took over what used to be Dr. Perlmutter's mm-hmm. clinic, Dr. Maristani.
I'm glad they're using it,
Yeah, and you guys, and all across, we have most of the major cities, we have people using this in most of the case, small to medium-sized practices.
Is there a directory, because this podcast goes out all over the country and literally around the world. Is there a directory, state by state or country by country for people who, would prefer not to travel, hundreds of thousands of miles to find a practitioner who does this test?
Absolutely, yes. So on our website, we have some featured users who are some of our most experienced users, and that has, again, people from that used to be Mayo Clinic and lots of wonderful practitioners. But we will provide, somebody can go through our website and request a list of people licensed in their state. We don't put our whole directory up on our website because some people prefer to have their names released only to the people in their state. They don't want calls from, you know, drug reps and things like that. So they, but absolutely anyone who's interested, we are happy to give them a list of people who are comfortable and experienced in providing this kind of information in their state.
Right. And, you know, I have to say that the interpretation of these tests is challenging, but the education that you provide to your practitioners is really top notch. And I've really found it a fascinating intellectual exercise to work with you to begin to understand the potential of this emerging science. You know, we must state that this is a science that's in evolution, and you would be the first person to admit that we're learning more and more, you know, every day, you know, every week new studies come out suggesting new implications of various genes in terms of health conditions and the application of certain nutrients. And, you know, so this is a work in progress. It's a dynamic test that, you know, you keep modifying and improving as the new findings come out.
Yes, that's actually one of my favorite things. I love to research. I started doing research, you know, back in high school and college, and people are always sending me studies. Our research team is always reading.
I do. So I constantly bug you with studies. I mean, I see it. I send it to you. I said, like, you know, maybe she doesn't have time, or I hope she finds it interesting, but I keep sending you stuff.
I love your studies, but like just today, we added some variants that relate to a different detox pathway that you modify with vitamin C because it's part of activating vitamin C that can increase the risk of cataracts like 3.4-fold. And interestingly, vitamin C has been shown to help prevent cataracts. Well, it probably will help even more in the people who have these variants. And this pathway also relates to arsenic, and vitamin C has also been shown to help clear arsenic. So we're, you know, we just added some more inflammatory pathways, some more things in stroke. So we're constantly adding, and constantly we have over 100 different topics in development. So,
And that's interesting because when I look up a patient, when I click on your website, it says generate a new report. And what, so the DNA is always the same. It never changes. So that DNA, that sample was submitted, you know, say it was submitted in 2018, but in 2021, that report will look a lot different than it did in 2018, correct? Because new interpretations and new implications are being added, you know, virtually on a daily basis.
Correct. We have the ability to add quite a bit more. Right now, we show a few hundred, you know, about 600 or so variants that we've spent the time and feel like we understand well enough to give doctors enough information that they can use. But there are a couple hundred thousand on our array. So give us time.
Indeed. I really feel that, you know, we're on the cusp of a revolution in our understanding of disease, and also the interaction between our genes and lifestyle and nutrients. And I, you know, that really is on, you know, the cutting edge of integrative medicine. So, you know, kudos to you. Congratulations for taking it on. It's challenging work, but, you know, it's obviously got some real life payoffs. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Sharon Hausman-Cohen, Chief Medical Officer of Intellix DNA. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Hi, this is Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Tending your cardiovascular health requires much more than simply lowering your cholesterol. Maintaining heart health requires a combination of diet and lifestyle choices, along with a smart regimen of supplementation. That's why I've created the Intelligent Medicine Heart Health Protocol, my personal supplement recommendations to reduce your heart risk. Just go to drhoffmanstore.com for details. And for a limited time, you'll get free shipping on all of your store orders. For more details, just go to drhoffmanstore.com. That's drhoffmanstore.com.